This is Computer Science 455 for 2nd of September 2009. Which I have now done. So, so we missed the first few minutes here. I forgot entirely in 355 on Monday. So somebody's got to take on the task of remembering to ask me, did you start it? Okay. Processes, okay, so we've talked about our applications in terms of hosts so far, but, you know, hosts are just computers. They sit there, they have processors and memory and disks, and they don't do anything unless there are programs running on them. And the programs that run on computers these days are typically executing inside a process, right? You have a Unix process, you have a Windows process. What is a process? It's a execution context for a program. It's a stack and memory, virtual memory, and a program counter that sort of pops around through the program as it runs. And so that's a running program in a computer. If we have two programs running in the computer at the same time, they can talk to each other using inter-process communication mechanisms like shared memory, semaphores. When we do concurrent programming class, we can talk about that a lot more. I was asked about that this morning. Am I teaching concurrent programming in the spring? Maybe. We'll see. But when processes are in different computers, when programs are running in different computers, then they have to interact over the network, and they do that by sending messages to each other. It turns out that inter-process communication is often message-based as well. You know, if you want to run a web server on your own machine and have your web browser talk to it, we don't use a separate set of protocols for that. We just use the networking protocols and have the computer internally, the operating system internally, implement the network protocols. Okay, so it turns out that computers are not clients and servers. Processes are clients and servers, really, because the computer is just a hot hunk of silicon. You have to have programs. The programs are in processes. So we have client processes and server processes, and we'll just push through this distinction again, or observation, that it's the client that initiates and the server is a passive entity. It also clarifies this idea that in a peer-to-peer situation, you may have processes that act like client processes and processes that act like server processes. And even more challenging is to have a single process that acts like both. Right? And all of those are possible. And we'll see when we talk about programming how to accomplish all of those. Okay, I think they don't do a very good job with this next thing, so I'm going to try to clarify a bit based on what's on the slides and also what's in the book. I think there's a bit clearer picture that can be drawn about what is a socket now. So here's the issue. You have a running process, a running program in a computer host, and it needs access to the network. And the way it gets it is through what's known as the Socket Application Program Interface, the Socket API. That's a characteristic of the operating system. That programs can use that interface to cause messages to flow in the network, right? And we're going to talk a lot about that socket API when we talk about programming. But for now, it suffices to say that a socket is a representation of a channel over the network, as seen by an application. And that's, I think, what these guys in their description, to my way of thinking, don't make too clear, is that the socket notion is one of how applications talk to the network through the operating system. Okay? Because there's another concept here coming up on in the next couple of slides called a port. And a port is not equal to a socket. Okay, and that's important to understand. Let me stop here and ask if there are any questions. Going right through this. Okay, so as this last bullet points out here, the socket API gives applications the ability to choose some characteristics of this network channel that they're going to be using. They can say whether it's a sort of connection-oriented channel or a what's called a datagram-oriented channel, and it can fix some parameters about that channel, like how big its buffers are and some other characteristics that don't really matter. But the important thing that I want you to get is that the socket API is between the application and the OS. Okay? The OS builds this structure to help support applications in doing their thing. Okay, we mentioned before that hosts have 32-bit IP addresses. We'll talk more about what form they take when we get to the network layer, but it's a more or less unique number that corresponds to a particular host in the internet. There are fine points of detail there that make that statement make me have to say more or less unique. Okay. And so the question is an IP address a sufficient identifier for somebody to send a message to a process on a computer? No. Right? Because there may be many processes running on the computer. What we have to do is we have to get a message. Let's see. Let me draw my picture again here. We have the app above, the OS below, and we have a message coming in to the OS over, say, the Ethernet. And based on what's in that message, and maybe some state that's kept in the OS, I have to figure out which socket that message has to be delivered to. See that? Okay? So the IP address is not sufficient because there may be many sockets that could get that message. So to overcome this, at the transport layer, introduces the notion of ports. Okay? So in the transport layers that we usually talk about, this is a 16-bit number that gets added to the message. So we have the IP address that works at the network layer and makes sure that the message gets the correct host. And then at the transport layer, we have another 16-bit number that says which, that helps the host figure out which socket that message needs to be sent to. All right? Now, it's not the same as the socket. I want to be really clear about that. The port number is not the socket. Okay? It's just more information that helps the OS figure out which socket it's supposed to be. Okay, so the identifier includes the IP address and the port numbers. And so examples of port numbers, port number 80 is often associated with HTTP servers, 25 with mail servers. So there's a collection of these called the well-known ports. And if you have a Linux system or Unix system, and maybe if you have a Windows system, you can look in a file called services. In Linux systems, it's etc services. And you will find ports listed, port numbers listed, and it will say TCP or UDP, standing for the two kinds of different kinds of transport that are typically used, and then the name of the service that's associated with that port. And so there are a bunch of these. They're all less than 1024, I think, usually. And then there's, of course, another 63,000 numbers that can be used on each host dynamically to help programs identify to other programs elsewhere in the network how the communication should be delivered. Okay? So, be clear. Ports are not sockets. They're related to sockets, but they are not sockets. Okay, so protocols. Back to protocols. Protocols, remember, are rules about communication. They say what the messages are, what order they're exchanged in, and to a certain extent, what they mean. Right? So, I think it's best to look at examples to understand protocols more. I'm not going to spend more time on this slide. But before we can talk about instances of protocols, we need to first ask ourselves what sort of data delivery service do different applications need? Okay? So remember, our model is we've got these applications, they've got a protocol, they send messages, they receive messages. But applications have vastly different purposes in life, and they have different needs of the transport service. So, for example, data loss. Some kinds of applications don't really care very much if you lose a bit of data. For example, if you're watching television and you miss one frame out of 30 that were going to happen during a second, well, you're not going to get too upset about that, right? And you'd much rather have that frame be lost than have the whole thing come to a halt while the television viewing program tries to recover from the fact that it had a loss, right? That would be much worse than simply missing one frame. On the other hand, when we're doing things like web browsing, it's pretty annoying if you only get the top third and bottom third of the page, right? You wouldn't like that very well. So different applications care differently about data loss. Different applications care differently about timing. Things like web services, we're generally happy if we get the page in a second or two. On the other hand, if I'm talking to you and we're trying to have a conversation, a quarter of a second is considered too much delay for a pleasant conversation. It's sort of the limit of how much delay we could tolerate in hearing each other. Some applications care vastly about how fast we can transfer files. Okay? So others will use whatever they can get. If I'm sucking over an image of a website in order to clone it and offer a mirror service of it, maybe I don't care so much about how long that takes. Whereas if I'm trying to watch TV, I care very much about the bandwidth. So we've got a table that illustrates different applications on these three dimensions. So, what do I want you to know about that? I want you to know that this variability exists, and I want you to be able to think through the case for an application on each of these dimensions. Why would we say that file transfer requires no loss, but its throughput requirement is elastic, and it's not time sensitive? Why would we say that? Yeah. Be able to think, if I propose an application to you, be able to think about that. Okay. So that's the view of the world from the different applications perspectives. The internet at the network layer offers primarily two different, in the internet at the transport layer, we typically offer two different kinds of service. What's called a connection-oriented service, which goes by the name TCP, which stands for Transmission Control Protocol. And UDP is the Unreliable Datagram Protocol. So two different, primarily two different services at the transport layer. And TCP seems pretty good, right? It offers reliable transport. It is careful that the sender doesn't send too much data to overflow either the network or the receiver. And if you didn't have a perspective of saying applications have different needs, you might say TCP is all we need. Okay? But recognizing different applications have different needs, we see that in particular reliable transport is a big bugaboo for applications that don't care about reliability but do care about timing. Okay? So the designers of the internet way back in the early days came up with these two different kinds of transport to support different kinds of applications. They've served pretty well, and application builders like builders of things like Skype and YouTube and so forth get along pretty well with these, but we have, you know, visible glitches in those applications because of the fact that maybe they don't have perfectly matching transport services available. But to develop one of these is a big, big effort, and to get it deployed into hundreds of millions of different hosts is also a huge effort. So transport protocols don't get created every day, let's say. So UDP is little more than IP itself. Okay. That the service provided by UDP is essentially that provided by IP, It just adds a port number and a little error checking. So it's really minimal. Remember when we talked about how we had the application level message and we added the transport header and then we added the internet header. What a mess. The transport header for TCP is a lot bigger than the one for UDP because it has a lot more to do. And we will definitely be looking at what that looks like when we get to the next chapter. So who uses what? Well, things that require reliable data transfer tend to favor TCP. Things that require that don't require reliable transfer and have the ability to absorb loss of data will typically favor UDP. Okay, Sean.
Is there another way to indicate on each packet if you're sending over TCP that you don't care if it's dropped or not?
There is not a way to indicate that. Yep. Because, and we'll see this when we get to TCP, we'll see that it doesn't actually have any notion of packets in it at all. Okay. So, in order to sort of solidify this picture, we're going to look in quite a bit of detail at the web protocol, specifically HTTP. All right, so these guys have their own way of describing what's a web page. HTML, hypertext markup language. So hypertext is now in such common use that we don't even worry about its definition anymore, but from about 1975 on, it was a big thing, right? Hypertext, because nobody could do it in any sensible way. Hypertext is the idea that you can have some text, and within it, flag a bit of other text as being clickable on and take you off to somewhere else. So that's sort of like hyperdrive in space, right? You're reading through it and you can hyper out to someplace else. So these days, ever since you guys were mostly born, hypertext and the web is a way of life, but it had its own name back whenever. Okay, so a web page consists of a file consisting of some of this hypertext, which contains in it links or references to other objects that exist in the web, which can be other text, it could be images, applets, audio, video, you know, great variety of different things that can be linked to from a HTML file. And what you see in your browser then is what we think of as a web page that consists of all these objects. So the way we address the way we write these links is by using things called uniform resource locators. URLs, and this is actually not a valid example. To be a URL, it needs to be HTTP, what is it, :// because a real URL starts with a protocol name. And the protocol name for web pages is HTTP.
Why is the www not always required? It depends on the web server.
It depends on the name. It can be anything at all. It just this has to identify a host. This is a location on the host. Okay? And think about it. Think about the earlier discussion. We said a host name alone is not enough, right? We have to identify the process that we want to handle this request when we send it. And that's where this comes in. Right? Now, when the message arrives at the host, what do we need to have? We need to have a port number associated with the message in order to get it to the web server process. And that's really the role of this HTTP. It says, in the absence of any other information, you should look up the port number associated with the HTTP protocol in services file, which turns out to be 80, and associate that with the message. You can optionally put here in your URL : port number. It comes right before this first slash, and that will cause it to that's an interesting case. That says, all right, the port number that goes in the message comes from here, but the protocol, the rules for the messages, come from here, HTTP. Okay, so other things that can be here are mail to, HTTPS, right? Secure web access. There are quite a few of them. There's one for connecting to telephones. Call to, I believe. Anyway, and people make those up all the time. It's relatively easy to add application protocols to the world. Right? You just start doing it. Eventually, if you want your name to be recognized worldwide, you want to register it with the Internet Naming Authority, but you don't have to in order to start experimenting with it. You and your colleagues who want to have interactions this way, go for it. Okay, so HTTP, Hypertext Transfer Protocol. It's a request-response protocol. The client sends a request, and the server sends an answer. Okay? It's also known as stateless, which means that the server, once it has sent the answer, doesn't remember anything more about the request as far as HTTP is concerned. Uses TCP. It's built over TCP. When we get web pages, we want them to be delivered completely. A little bit more about statelessness and why we do it. Simplification. It was a great idea at the time when Tim Berners-Lee created HTTP and HTML to do it with a stateless server, because it simplifies the implementation of the server a great deal. We suffer from that today with the sort of hoops that people have to jump through in order to build things like stores on the web where you want to build a shopping cart, right? And shopping cart is really state. You had that in had that interaction and said, I want to buy that many of that thing, and then I go back to the catalog, I look some more, I want to buy some more of something else, I keep building this up. That's building up a state that ultimately we're going to buy a basket of goods. HTTP does not directly support that. Okay? It's an add-on to support that. We'll see how that's done here in a second. Okay, so I think I need to stop there because this next little discussion is going to extend for a while. Any questions? We have a couple minutes for questions, if there are any. So keep in mind that this is important. You're going to be building something that does, that interacts in this space, right? When you build a proxy server.
I have one question.
Sure.
In programming, we have tons of different languages for everything, but I feel like there's vastly fewer for the internet. Is that a mistake? Like, I feel like I'm like HTTP, CSS, like, those kind of things, but there's not anywhere near as many as the
as there are programming languages.
Well, at least generally that we compile all of our higher level languages to HTML and JavaScript and CSS rather than interpreting them in the browser.
I think it's a matter of you know, the internet is all about communicating with people. You can't play in your own sandbox, right? If you want to use some other language on the internet, you have to at least get somebody to agree with you to do it. And to get sort of big, you have to convince a lot of people. So
you can write a page in any language you want and just instead of present HTML out.
Yeah.
HTML isn't a programming language, it's more of a presentation style. So instead of like printing out, you know, text, you print out HTML.
Yeah. But it extends beyond HTML. I mean, we do mail in certain ways, right? We don't, right? We did pop mail for a long time, and then somebody came up with IMAP, and there were problems with IMAP 3, and so IMAP 4 happened, and that's it, and we're done. So, okay, we're done. Thanks, guys.